ugly breed, but a robust and healthy one. The excellent beast had done 5 leagues in 2 hours, and there was not a drop of sweat on his rump. He did not get down from the tilbury. The young stable hand who brought the oats knelt down suddenly and examined the left wheel. "Have you got a long trip ahead of you in this?" the boy said. He responded almost as though he were still lost in thought. "Why?" "Have you come a long way?" the boy ploughed on. 5 leagues.
"Ah!"
"Why do you say ah?" The boy bent down again, said nothing for a moment, his gaze riveted on the wheel, then stood up and said,
"It's just that if that wheel's just done 5 leagues, and it's possible at a pinch, it won't do another quarter of a league, that's for sure."
He leaped down from the tilbury. "What are you saying, my friend?"
"I'm saying that it's a miracle you went 5 leagues without taking a tumble, you and your horse, into a ditch on the highway. Have a look."
The wheel was indeed seriously damaged. The shock of the mail chest had split 2 spokes and loosened the hub so that the nut had worked its way out. "My friend," he said to the stable hand, "is there a wheelwright around here?"
"Naturally, monsieur."
"Do me a favor and go and get him."
"He's just there, 2 feet away."
"Coué! Master Bourgaillard!"
Master Bourgaillard, the wheelwright, was standing on his doorstep. He came and examined the wheel and made a grimace like a surgeon looking at a broken leg. "Can you fix the wheel right away?"
"Yes, monsieur."
"When can I get going again?"
"Tomorrow."
"Tomorrow?"
"There's a full day's work there. Is monsieur in a hurry?"
"In a great hurry. I have to get going again in an hour at the latest."
"Not possible, monsieur."
"I'll pay whatever you want."
"Not possible."
"Well, then, 2 hours."
"Not possible today. There are 2 spokes and a hub to repair. Monsieur can't set off again before tomorrow."
"My business can't wait till tomorrow. What if you don't repair the wheel and replace it instead?"
"How can I do that?"
"You're a wheelwright, aren't you?"
"I certainly am, monsieur.
Haven't you got a wheel you could sell me? I could start out again at once."
"A replacement wheel?"
"Yes."
"I don't have a wheel ready-made for your cabriolet. 2 wheels don't just fit together willy-nilly."
"In that case, sell me a pair of wheels."
"Monsieur, all wheels don't just fit all axles. Give it a try, anyway." "There's no point, monsieur. I've only got cartwheels for sale. This is the sticks here."
"Would you have a cabriolet I could hire?" The master wheelwright had seen at a glance that the tilbury was a hire car. He shrugged his shoulders.
"You certainly know how to look after the cabriolets you hire. Even if I had one, I wouldn't let you rent it."
"Well, then sell it to me."
"I haven't got one."
"What? Not even a cariole? I'm not hard to please, as you can see."
"This is the sticks here. I do have an old barouche under cover over there,"
the wheelwright added.
"It belongs to a burgher in town who gave it to me to look after. He only uses it once in a blue moon. I'd let you have that for hire. What's it to me? But the burgher mustn't see it going past. And then again, it's a barouche. You'd need 2 horses.
"I'll take 2 post horses.
"Where is monsieur off to?"
"Arras."
"And monsieur wants to get there today?"
"I certainly do."
"With post horses?
"Why not?"
"Does monsieur mind if he gets there overnight, at 4 in the morning?
"No, of course not."
"It's just that, you see, there's something that has to be said about taking post horses. Does monsieur have his passport?"
"Yes."
"Well, then, if monsieur takes 'post horses, he won't get to Arras before tomorrow. We're at crossroads here. The relays aren't manned. The horses are in the fields. The ploughing season's starting. You need good, strong teams under yoke, and they're grabbing horses left, right, and center from the post just the same as anywhere else. Monsieur will have to wait for 3 or 4 horses at every relay, and then they'll only go pretty slowly. There are so many uphill stretches to climb."
"All right, I'll go on horseback. Unhitch the cabriolet. Surely someone in this place can sell me a saddle."
"Of course. But will this horse let you saddle him?"
"That's right. You've just reminded me he won't."
"Well,
but surely I can find a horse for hire in the village."
"A horse to do the trip to Arras in one go?"
"That's right."
"You'd need a better horse than you'll see in this neck of the woods. You'd have to buy it first, because we don't know you from Adam. But there's nothing for sale, nothing for hire, not for 500 francs and not for 1,000 neither. You won't find one."
"What can I do?"
"The best thing, if you're going to be sensible about it, is for me to fix the wheel and for you to put your trip back till tomorrow."
"Tomorrow will be too late."
"Jesus!
Isn't there a mail coach that goes to Arras? When does it come through?"
"Tomorrow night. Both the mail coaches run at night, the one going up as well as the one going down."
"And it will really take you a day to fix the wheel?"
"A day, and a full day at that."
What if you put two workers on it?
It'd take 10.
What if we tied the spokes with rope?
The spokes, all right, the hub, no go. Then again, the rim's in a bad way, too.
Is there a car hire place in town?
No.
Is there another wheelwright? The stable boy and the wheelwright answered at the same time, shaking their heads.
No.
He felt a great rush of joy. It was obvious Providence had a hand in this. It was Providence that had busted the wheel of the Tilbury and stopped him en route. He had not given up at the first sign of trouble. He had just done all he could to continue on his way. He had faithfully and scrupulously exhausted every means. He had not shrunk either before the season or before fatigue or before the expense. He had nothing to reproach himself with. If he were to go no further, it would not worry him. It was no longer his fault. It was not an act of his own volition, but an act of God. He breathed. He breathed freely and filled his lungs for the first time since Javert's visit. It felt as if the iron fist that had squeezed his heart for the last 20 hours had just let go. It felt as if God was now on his side and was making it known. He told himself he'd done everything he could, and that now all he had to do was go back the way he'd come, quietly. If his conversation with the wheelwright had taken place in a room at the inn, there would have been no witnesses, no one would have heard it, things would have been left at that, and it is quite likely that we would not have to relate any of the events you are going to read about. But this conversation took place in the street. Any talk in the street inevitably gathers a circle of people. There are always people crying out to be spectators. While he was questioning the wheelwright, a few passers-by had stopped around them. After listening in for a few minutes, one young lad, whom no one had taken any notice of, broke away from the group and ran off. The very moment the traveller ended the inner debate we have just detailed, and decided to go back the way he had come, the boy returned. He was accompanied by an old woman.
"Monsieur," said the woman, "my boy tells me you're after a cabriolet to rent."
Those simple words, uttered by an old woman shepherded by a child, caused sweat to trickle down his back. He felt as if he could see the hand that had just released him reappear in the gloom behind him, ready to grab him again. He answered, "Yes, my good woman, I am looking for a cabriolet to rent." And he hastened to add, "But there aren't any around here."
"Yes, there are," said the old woman.
"Where is that, then?"
the wheelwright chipped in.
"At my place," replied the old woman.
He shivered. The fatal hand gripped him once more. The old woman did, in fact, have a kind of wicker carryall in her shed. The wheelwright and the stable boy from the inn, sorry to see the traveller escape their clutches, stepped in. It was a dreadful old bone shaker, just a box plonked on top of the bare axle, no springs. The seats were actually hung inside from strips of leather. The rain got in, the wheels were rusty and eaten away with damp. It wouldn't go much farther than the Tilbury, a real rattle-trap. The monsieur would be making a dreadful mistake to set out in it. And so on, and so forth. All the above was true. But this bone-shaker, this rattle-trap, this thing, whatever it was, rolled along on its two wheels and could make it to Arras. He paid the asking price, left the Tilbury at the wheelwright's for repair to be picked up on his return trip, had the white horse harnessed to the carriole, hopped up, and went on his way, following the road he'd been on since early morning. The moment the cart lurched forward, he confessed to himself that a minute before he had felt a certain joy at the thought that he would not get where he was going. He examined this joy with a sort of fury and found it absurd. Why rejoice at going backward? After all, he was making this trip of his own free will. No one was forcing him to do it. And naturally, nothing would happen that he didn't want to happen. As he was leaving Hesdin, he heard a voice shouting, "Stop! Stop!" He pulled the cart up with a sharp jerk that still had something strangely feverish and convulsive about it, resembling hope. It was the little boy who belonged to the old woman. "Monsieur," he said,
I'm the one who got you this card.
Right.
You didn't give me anything.
He who gave to everyone, and so easily, found this claim exorbitant and almost vile.
Ah, so it was you, you little rascal, he said. You won't get a thing.
He whipped the horse and galloped off hard. He had lost a lot of time in Ada, and wanted to make it up. The little horse was brave and pulled like two, but they were in the month of February. It had rained and the roads were bad. And then it was not the Tilbury now. The cart was hard and very heavy. On top of this, there were lots of hills. It took him nearly 4 hours to get from Hesdin to Saint-Paul. 4 hours to do 5 leagues. At Saint-Paul, he unharnessed the horse at the first inn he came to and had the horse taken to the stable. Just as he had promised Scaufflaire, he stayed close to the hayrack while the horse was eating. His mind was on sad and confused things. The wife of the innkeeper came into the stable. "Wouldn't monsieur like something to eat?"
"Heavens, it's true," he said. "I've actually worked up quite an appetite."
He followed the woman, who had a fresh, happy face. She led him into a low room where there were tables with oilskins for tablecloths.
"Please be quick," he said. "I have to set out again. I'm in a hurry."
A fat Flemish servant promptly set the table for him. He watched the girl with a feeling of well-being.
"That was what was wrong with me," he thought. "I didn't have anything to eat."
He was served. He fell on the bread, bit a great mouthful off, then slowly put the bread back on the table and didn't touch it again. A cart driver was eating at another table. He said to the man, "Why is the bread here so bitter?" The cart driver was German and didn't understand. He went back to the stable and over to the horse. An hour later he was out of Saint-Paul heading for Tank, which is only 5 leagues from Arras. What did he do during this part of the trip? What was he thinking? Just as he had done that morning, he watched the trees go by, the thatched roofs, the fields under cultivation, and the vanishing stretches of the landscape shifting at every bend in the road. This is a kind of contemplation that sometimes satisfies the soul and almost allows it to dispense with thinking. To see 1,000 things for the first time and for the last, what could be more melancholy or more profound? To travel is to be born and to die at every instant. Perhaps in the most shadowy part of his mind he was making connections between those shifting horizons and human existence itself. Everything in life is constantly fleeing in a headlong rush ahead of us. Things cloud over and clear as part and parcel of the same process. First dazzlement, then eclipse. You look, you rush around, you hold out your hands to seize what is passing. Every event is a bend in the road, and then, all of a sudden, you're old. You feel a sort of jolt. Everything is black. You make out a dim doorway. That somber horse of life that was dragging you along stops, and you see someone veiled and unknown unharness it in the shadows. Twilight was falling just as children coming out of school saw the traveller driving into Tank, for it was, of course, still that time of year when the days are short. He did not stop in Tank. As he was driving out of the village, a roadmender laying stones on the road raised his head and said, "That's a tired horse for you." The poor creature was, in fact, going no faster than a walk.
"Are you headed for Arras?" the roadmender added.
"Yes. If you keep going at that pace, you won't get there too early."
He stopped the horse and asked the man, "How much further is it from here to Arras?"
"A good 7 leagues, just about."
"How do you work that out?" "The post-book has it down as 5 1/4 leagues.
"Ah,"
the roadmender went on, "so you don't know the road is under repair? You'll find it cut off 1/4 hour from here. No way you can go any further." "Really?"
"You take the left, the road that goes to Carency, you cross the river, and when you get to Comblain, you turn right. That's the Mont-Saint-Éloi road that goes to Arras."
"But night's coming, I'll get lost."
"You're not from around here?"
"No."
"And they're all back roads, too. Wait a minute, monsieur," the man went on. "Do you want my advice?"
Your horse is weary. Go back to Tank. There's a good inn there. Have a sleep. You'll go to Arras tomorrow.
I have to be there tonight.
That's different. Well, go back all the same to the inn and take a fresh horse. The boy that comes with the horse will guide you through all the back roads.
He followed the roadmender's advice and went back the way he'd come. And half an hour later, he was going past the same spot again, but at quite a gallop with a good fresh horse. A stable boy who styled himself a postillion was perched on the shaft of the cart. Yet he felt he was losing time. It was now completely dark. They turned off into the back roads. The road surface was terrible. The cart fell into one rut after another. He said to the postillion, "Keep up the pace and you get double the tip." During one of the shudders, the single tree broke.
"Monsieur," said the postillion, "the single tree's gone and broken. I don't know how to hitch up my horse. This road is pretty awful at night. If you'd like to come back and sleep in Tank, we could be in Arras early tomorrow morning."
He replied, "Have you got a bit of rope and a knife?"
"Yes, monsieur."
He cut off the branch of a tree and turned it into a single tree. It meant losing another 20 minutes, but then they set out again at a gallop. The plain was in darkness. Low, thick, black mists crept up the hillsides and tore away from them like smoke. There were pale streaks of light in the clouds. A great wind coming in from the sea made a noise like someone moving furniture around all along the horizon. Everything that you could make out in the darkness looked to be terror-stricken. So many things shudder under the blast of the immense breaths of night. The cold cut him to the bone. He hadn't eaten since the day before. He dimly remembered his other nocturnal trip on the great plain not far from Digne. That was 8 years ago, yet it seemed to him only yesterday. A distant bell struck the hour. He asked the boy, "What time is it?"
7 o'clock, monsieur. We'll be in Arras by 8. We've only got 3 leagues to go."
At that instant, something occurred to him for the first time, and he found it odd that he hadn't thought of it before. That it was perhaps pointless, all this trouble he was going to. That he didn't even know what time the trial was on. That he might at least have found out about that, that it was mad to go on like this without knowing if it would serve any purpose. Then he made a few calculations in his head, that normally the sessions of the circuit courts began at 9 o'clock in the morning, that this particular matter would probably not take long, that a case of apple-stealing would be over in a jiffy, that it would be just a question of identity after that. 4 or 5 statements, nothing much the lawyers could say, that he was going to get there when it was all over. The postillion whipped the horses. They had crossed the river and left Mont-Saint-Éloi behind them. Night grew deeper and deeper. Sister Simplice is put to the test. Meanwhile, at that very moment, Fantine was delirious with joy. She had had a very bad night. Hideous cough, galloping fever. And she had had dreams. In the morning, when the doctor dropped in, she was delirious. She seemed alarmed and asked them to tell her as soon as Monsieur Madeleine arrived. The whole morning she was distraught, said little, and made pleats in the sheets while murmuring figures softly to herself that sounded like they were calculations of distance. Her eyes were hollow and staring. They seemed almost to have gone out, and then, at times, they lit up again and shone like stars. It would seem that at the approach of a certain dark hour, the brightness of the sky fills those who are leaving the brightness of the earth. Every time Sister Simplice asked her how she felt, she invariably answered, "Good, I'd like to see Monsieur Madeleine." Some months previously, at the time that Fantine had lost what was left of her modesty, what was left of her shame, what was left of her happiness, she'd been a shadow of her former self. Now she was a ghost of her former self. Physical suffering had finished the job of moral suffering. This creature, only 25 years old, had a forehead covered in wrinkles, flaccid cheeks, pinched nostrils, receding gums, a grayish complexion, a skinny neck, protruding collarbones, withered limbs, sallow skin, and her blonde hair showed gray at the roots. Alas, that's how suffering improvises on old age. At midday, the doctor came back, wrote out a few prescriptions, inquired as to whether Monsieur le Maire had turned up yet at the infirmary, and shook his head. Monsieur Madeleine usually came at 3 o'clock to see the sick woman. As punctuality was part of goodness, he was punctual. Close to 2:30, Fantine began to get agitated. In the space of 20 minutes, she asked the nun more than 10 times, "Sister, what time is it?" The clock struck 3. At the 3rd stroke, Fantine sat bolt upright. She, who normally could barely move in her bed, she joined her 2 bony, yellowed hands together in a sort of convulsive clasp, and the nun heard one of those deep sighs issue from her chest that seemed to lift a great weight, release despair. Then Fantine turned and looked at the door. No one came in. The door did not open. She stayed in this position for 1/4 hour, her eye fixed on the door, not moving and as though holding her breath. The sister didn't dare speak to her. The church struck 3:15. Fantine let herself fall back on the pillow. She didn't say a word, and began to pleat the sheet again. The 1/2 hour went by, then the hour. No one came. Every time the clock struck, Fantine pushed herself up and looked toward the door, then fell back again. It was obvious what she was thinking, but she did not utter a name. She did not complain, she did not accuse. Only she coughed, horribly. You would have said something dark was battening down on her. She was livid, and her lips were blue. At times she smiled. 5 o'clock struck. The sister then heard her say, very softly and sweetly, "But since I'm going away tomorrow, it's wrong of him not to come today." Sister Simplice herself was surprised that Monsieur Madeleine hadn't yet turned up. Meanwhile, Fantine was gazing at the canopy over her bed. She looked as though she were trying to remember something. Suddenly, she began to sing in a voice as weak as a breath. The nun listened. This is what Fantine sang. "We'll buy some beautiful things as we stroll down the boulevards. Roses are red, violets are blue. Violets are blue, and my love is true. The Virgin Mary next to my stove came to see me yesterday in a brocade coat, and said, 'Here, hidden beneath my veil, the little one you once asked me for. Run to town, get some cloth, buy some thread, buy a thimble. We'll buy some beautiful things as we stroll down the boulevards. Good Holy Virgin next to my stove, I've done a cradle up with ribbons. God could give me his brightest star. I prefer the baby you gave me by far. My lady, what will I do with the cloth? Make a trousseau for my newborn babe. Roses are red, violets are blue. Violets are blue, my love is true. Wash the cloth, but where? In the river. Make it, without spoiling it or dirtying it, into a pretty skirt with a chemise, which I'll embroider all over with flowers. The baby's gone, my lady. What will I do? Make it into a shroud to bury me in. We'll buy some beautiful things as we stroll down the boulevards. Roses are red, violets are blue. Violets are blue. My love is true.' This song was an old nursery rhyme she used to sing in bygone days to rock her little Cosette to sleep. And it hadn't sprung to mind in all the 5 years she no longer had her baby with her. She sang it in a voice so sad and so sweet that it would make even a nun weep. The sister, accustomed to austerity, felt a tear well in her eye. The clock struck 6. Fantine didn't seem to hear. She didn't seem to notice anything around her anymore. Sister Simplice sent a servant girl off to ask the concierge at Monsieur le Maire's workshop if he had returned and if he would not shortly come to the infirmary. The girl was back in a flash. Fantine still had not moved, and seemed to be absorbed in her own thoughts. The servant told Sister Simplice in a whisper that Monsieur le Maire had left that same morning before 6 o'clock in a little tilbury harnessed to a white horse, freezing as it was, that he had set out alone, without even a driver, that no one knew what road he'd taken, that some people said they saw him take the Arras turn, that others reckoned they passed him on the road to Paris. That as he went off, he was very sweet as usual, and that all he said to the concierge was not to wait up for him that night. While the two women were whispering with their backs turned to Fantine's bed, the sister asking questions and the servant speculating, Fantine, with the feverish vivacity certain organic diseases produce, combining vigorous, healthy motion with the dreadful cadaverousness of death, had got to her knees on the bed, with her two clenched fists pressed into the bolster for support, and poking her head through the gap in the curtains, she strained to hear. Suddenly she yelled, "You're talking about Monsieur Madeleine there. Why are you whispering? What's he doing? Why isn't he coming?" Her voice was so harsh and so hoarse that the two women felt they were hearing a man's voice. They whirled around, frightened. "Well, answer me," cried Fantine. The servant stammered, "The concierge told me he couldn't come today." "My child," said the sister, "stay calm, lie back down." Fantine didn't move a hair, but only yelled loudly and in a tone at once imperious and harrowing, "He can't come, why not? You know the reason, you were whispering it amongst yourselves, I want to know." The servant hastened to whisper in the nun's ear, "Say he's busy with the municipal council." Sister Simplice went a bit red. What the servant was suggesting was that she tell a lie. On the other hand, it did seem to her that telling the sick woman the truth would no doubt be dealing her a tremendous blow, and that that would be dangerous in the state Fantine was in. Her blush did not last long. The sister turned her steady, sad eyes on Fantine and said, "Monsieur le maire has gone away." Fantine shot up and sat on her heels. Her eyes were glittering. An incredible sense of joy shone out of that painful face. "Gone away," she cried. "He's gone to get Cosette." Then she raised her hands to the heavens, and her whole face expressed ineffable happiness. Her lips moved. She was softly praying. When her prayer was done, she said, "Sister, I would like to lie down again now. I'll do whatever you like. A moment ago I was bad. Please forgive me for shouting. It's very bad to shout. I'm well aware of that, my good sister, but as you see, I'm very happy now. God is good. Monsieur Madeleine is good. Just think, he's gone to get my little Cosette in Montfermeil." She lay down again, helped the nun arrange her pillow, and kissed a little silver cross that she had round her neck and that Sister Simplice had given her. "My child," said the sister, "try to rest now. Don't talk any more." Fantine took the sister's hand in hers, which were so clammy it hurt the sister to feel the sweat. "He left this morning to go to Paris. You don't even need to go through Paris, actually. Montfermeil is a bit to the left on the way there. Do you remember how he said to me yesterday, when I was talking to him about Cosette, 'Soon, soon, he wants to give me a surprise. You know, he got me to sign a letter to get her away from the Thénardiers. There's nothing they can do, is there? They'll hand Cosette over, since they've got their money. Sister, don't tell me I mustn't talk. I'm so happy. I feel very well. I don't feel any more pain at all. I'm going to see Cosette again. I even feel quite hungry. It's nearly 5 years since I've seen her. You can't imagine what a hold children have over you. And then she'll be so nice, you'll see, if you only knew. She has such pretty little pink fingers. First thing, she's going to have very beautiful hands. When she was a year old, her hands were ridiculous. So, she must be big now. She's 7 years old. She's a young lady. I call her Cosette, but her real name is Euphrasie. Listen, only this morning I was looking at the dust on the mantelpiece, and I had a feeling I'd see Cosette again soon. My God, it's so wrong to let years go by without seeing your children. A person ought to realize that life is not forever. Oh, how good of Monsieur le Maire to have gone himself. It's true, it's very cold. Did he have his coat, at least? He'll be here tomorrow, won't he? Tomorrow. We'll have a party tomorrow morning. Sister, remind me to put on my little cap with the lace on it. Montfermeil is in the country. I did that road on foot once upon a time. For me it was a long way.
but coaches go so fast.
He'll be here tomorrow with Cosette. How far away is Montfermeil from here?
The sister, who had no idea of distances, replied,
Oh, I'm sure he can be back here tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow, said Fantine. I'll see Cosette tomorrow. You see, my good sister who belongs to our good Lord, I'm not sick any more. I'm mad with joy. I'd get up and dance if anyone wanted me to.
Anyone who had seen her a quarter of an hour earlier would not have believed their eyes. She was not quite so flushed. She spoke in a natural, lively voice. Her whole face was one big smile. At times she laughed as she muttered to herself. A mother's joy is almost the same as a child's joy.
Well, said the nun, look how happy you are now. So do as I say, and don't talk any more.
Fantine laid her head on the pillow and said, in a tiny voice,
Yes, lie down again. Be good, since you're going to see your little girl. She's right, Sister Simplice. All of them here are right.
And then, without moving a muscle, without shifting her head, she looked all around her with her eyes wide open and an air of joy, and she said nothing more. The sister closed the curtains, hoping she would doze off. Between 7 and 8, the doctor came. Not hearing any sound, he thought Fantine was sleeping, so he tiptoed quietly in and silently approached the bed. He pulled the curtains back a little, and by the light of the rushlight, he saw Fantine's great, calm eyes watching him. She said to him, Monsieur, they will, won't they, let me put her to bed beside me in a little cot, won't they? The doctor thought she was delirious. She added, Just look, there's just enough room. The doctor took Sister Simplice aside, and she explained the situation to him, how Monsieur Madeleine was away for a day or two, and how, in their doubtfulness, they had not thought it necessary to disillusion the poor sick woman who believed Monsieur le Maire had gone off to Montfermeil. How it was just possible, in a word, that she had guessed right. The doctor approved. He went back to Fantine's bed, and she went on. It's just that, you see, in the morning when she wakes up, I can say hello to the poor little bunny. And at night, since I don't sleep, I can listen to her sleeping. Her breathing is so faint and sweet, it'll do me good.
Give me your hand, said the doctor.
She held out her arm and laughed out loud as she cried,
Ah, heavens, that's right, you don't know. The thing is, I'm cured. Cosette'll be here tomorrow.
The doctor was startled. She was better. Her breathing was lighter, her pulse was stronger again. This poor, worn-out creature suddenly had a new lease on life.
Doctor, she went on, did Sister tell you that Monsieur le Maire's gone to get my little scallywag?
The doctor advised silence and avoidance of any painful emotion. He prescribed an infusion of pure quinine and, if she became feverish again, overnight, a soothing potion. As he was leaving, he said to the sister,
She's better. If by some happy chance Monsieur le Maire does turn up tomorrow with the child, who knows? There are some amazing recoveries. Great joy has been seen to put an end to disease. I know this one is an organic disease and fairly well advanced, but it's all such a mystery, all that.
Perhaps we will save her, after all.
The traveller arrives, only to get ready to leave again. It was nearly 8 o'clock at night when the cart we left on the road drove through the carriage entrance of the Hôtel de la Poste in Arras. The man we followed up to this moment hopped down, responded absent-mindedly to the eager attentiveness of the inn people, sent back the extra horse, and led the little white horse to the stable himself. Then he pushed open the door of a billiard room on the ground floor, took a seat there, and propped his elbows on a table. He had taken 14 hours to do a trip he had counted on doing in 6. To be fair to himself, he admitted that it was not his fault, but in his heart of hearts, he was not sorry. The hotel landlady came in. "Does Monsieur need to sleep? Will Monsieur have supper?" He shook his head in the negative. "The stable boy says Monsieur's horse is extremely tired." Here he broke his silence. "Won't the horse be able to set off again tomorrow?"
"Oh, Monsieur, he needs at least 2 days off,"
he asked. "The post office is here, isn't it?"
"Yes, Monsieur."
The hostess took him to the office. He showed his passport and asked if it was possible for him to go back to Montreuil-sur-Mer by mail coach that same night. As luck would have it, the seat next to the mailman was free. He reserved it and paid for it.
"Monsieur," said the post office clerk, "make sure you're back here ready to leave at 1 o'clock sharp in the morning."
That taken care of, he left the hotel and began to walk around the town. He did not know Arras. The streets were dingy, and he wandered around aimlessly. Yet he seemed determined not to ask directions from any passers-by. He crossed the little river, Crinchon, and found himself in a maze of narrow streets where he got lost. A bourgeois was making his way with a lantern. After some hesitation, he decided to speak to this man, but not without first looking in front and behind, as though he were frightened someone might overhear the question he was about to ask.
"Monsieur," he said, "the Palais de Justice, please."
"You're not a local, monsieur?" replied the burgher, who was a fairly old man. "Well, now follow me. I just so happen to be going close to the law courts, actually to the prefecture building next door. They're doing some work on the law courts at the moment, so the hearings are being held temporarily in the prefecture."
"Is that," he asked, "where the circuit court is sitting?"
"No doubt, monsieur. You see, what is now the prefecture used to be the bishop's palace before the revolution. Monsieur de Gonzier, who was bishop in 82, had a big reception room built there. It's in that room that the court is sitting."
As they walked along, the burgher said to him,
"If monsieur is hoping to sit in on a trial, he's a bit late. Normally sessions finish at 6.
But as they reached the big square, the burgher pointed out 4 tall windows lit up along the façade of a huge, gloomy building.
"Well, blow me down, monsieur, if you haven't got here in time. You're in luck. You see those 4 windows? That's the circuit court. The light's on, so it's not over. The thing must have dragged on, and they're having an evening session. Are you interested in this case? Is it a criminal trial, or your witness?"
He replied, "I haven't come for any case. I'm only here to speak to a lawyer."
"That's different," said the burgher. "Look, monsieur, there's the door, where the guard is. All you have to do is go up the main staircase."
He stuck to the man's directions, and a few minutes later he was in the room that was jammed with people, and where lawyers in their robes were huddled together here and there among the crowd, whispering. It always causes your heart to lurch, seeing these clusters of men in black murmuring among themselves sotto voce on the threshold of courts of law. It is rare that charity and pity emerge from all those words. What emerges most often is sentences handed down in advance, foregone conclusions. To the casual observer who lets his imagination run, all these men in groups huddled together look like so many sinister beehives where certain kinds of mind buzz away, building all kinds of bleak constructions together. The room, though spacious, was illuminated by a single lamp. It had once been the bishop's antechamber, but was being used as a waiting room for prisoners. A double door, closed at that moment, separated it from the great chamber where the circuit court was sitting. It was so dark that he wasn't frightened of addressing the first lawyer he came to.
"Monsieur," he said, "where are we up to?"
"It's over," said the lawyer.
"Over?"
This word had been repeated in such a tone that the lawyer turned around.
"Forgive me, monsieur, you are perhaps a relative?"
"No, I don't know anyone here." "And was there a sentence?"
"Naturally, it could scarcely be otherwise."
"Hard labor?"
"In perpetuity."
He went on in a voice so weak he could barely be heard.
"So his identity was confirmed?"
"Whose identity?" demanded the lawyer. "There was no identity to confirm. It was an open and shut case. The woman had murdered her child. Infanticide was proven. The jury ruled out premeditation. She was sentenced to life."
"It's a woman, then," he said.
But of course, the Limousin girl. What are you getting at?
Nothing. But since it's over, how come the light's still on in the room?
It's for the other case that started about 2 hours ago.
What other case?
Oh, this one's clear, too. Some poor swine, a recidivist, a galley slave who committed some kind of robbery. I can't quite remember his name, but I tell you, if anyone looked like a proper bandit, this one does. I'd send him to the galleys on the strength of his face alone.
Monsieur, he said, is there any way of getting into the room?
I really don't think so. It's pretty packed. But they're taking a break just now. A few people have stepped out so you could see what happens when the hearing resumes.
How do you get in?
Through the main door, there.
With that, the lawyer left him.
In a few moments he had experienced, almost at the same time, almost in the same breath, the whole gamut of possible emotions. The words of that cold-hearted man had pierced his heart like needles of ice or knives of fire. When he found out that nothing was finished, he breathed again, but he could not have said whether what he felt was satisfaction or pain. He stood next to several groups of people and eavesdropped. The court list was very full. The presiding judge had indicated that two straightforward, short matters were scheduled for that same day. They had started with the infanticide, and now they had moved on to the convict, the recidivist, the homing pigeon. This man had stolen some apples, but that did not seem to have been proven. What was proven was that he had already been in the galleys in Toulon. That is what ruined his case. The man's examination was already over, and the witness statements had been taken too, but still to come were the speech for the defense and the closing arguments of the public prosecutor's department. It would hardly be over before midnight. The man would most likely be found guilty. The counsel for the prosecution, a wit who made up rhymes, was good. He never missed his defendants. An usher stood by the door that led to the courtroom. He asked this usher, "Monsieur, will the door be open soon?"
"It will not be opened," replied the usher.
"What? Won't be opened again after the break? Isn't the court in recess?"
"The court has just resumed," replied the usher. "But the door will not be opened again."
"Why not?"
"Because the room is full."
"How's that? Aren't there any more seats?"
"Not a one. The door is closed. No one can get in now."
After a pause, the usher added,
"There are actually two or three seats behind Monsieur le Président, but the judge only allows public servants in there."
That said, the usher turned his back to him. He withdrew with his head down, crossed the antechamber, and slowly went back down the stairs as though hesitating at every step. It is likely he was holding counsel with himself. The violent struggle unleashed in him since the day before was not yet over. And at every moment it took a new turn. When he reached the landing, he leaned back against the rails and folded his arms. Suddenly, he fished inside his redingote, took out his pocketbook, pulled out a pencil, ripped out a page, and swiftly wrote the following line: "Monsieur Madeleine, mayor of Montreuil-sur-Mer." Then he flew back up the stairs, pushed through the crowd, went straight up to the usher, and said to him, in the voice of authority, "Give this to Monsieur le Président." The usher took the sheet of paper, glanced at it, and did what he asked. Preferential admission. Unbeknown to him, the mayor of Montreuil-sur-Mer enjoyed a kind of celebrity. For 7 years his reputation for virtue had spread throughout Lower Boulogne, and it had ended up jumping over the borders of a small country enclave and spreading into two or three neighboring departments. Apart from the considerable service he had rendered to the main town by getting the jet bead industry back on its feet, there was not one of the 141 communes in the arrondissement of Montreuil-sur-Mer that did not owe some benefit to him. He had even been able to boost and assist the industries of other arrondissements to prosper as the need arose. He had at times, accordingly, sustained with his own credit and his own funds the tool factory in Bologna, the mechanized flax mill in Frévent, and the hydraulic textile manufacturing of Boubet-sur-Conche. Everywhere the name of Monsieur Madeleine was uttered in veneration. Arras and Douai envied the happy little town of Montreuil-sur-Mer, its mayor. The judge of the royal court of Douai, who was presiding over this session of the circuit court in Arras,
like everybody else, knew this name so thoroughly and universally honored. When the usher discreetly opened the door between the council chamber and the courtroom, leaned down behind the judge's chair, and handed him the piece of paper on which the line we have just read was written, he added, "This gentleman would like to sit in on the proceedings." The judge made a sharp gesture of deference, grabbed a pen, jotted a few words at the bottom of the note, and handed it back to the usher, saying to him, "Let him in." The unfortunate man whose story we are relating had remained by the door of the hall at the same spot and in the same position as when the usher had left him. He heard someone say, in the middle of his daydream, "Would Monsieur do me the honor of following me?" It was this same usher who had turned his back on him a moment before, and who now bowed and scraped so low before him he practically swept the ground. At the same time, the usher handed him the note. He unfolded it, and, as he happened to be near the lamp, he was able to read, "The president of the circuit court would like to pay his respects to Monsieur Madeleine." He screwed the note up in his hand as though those few words left him with a strange and bitter aftertaste. He followed the usher. A few minutes later, he found himself alone in a kind of paneled chamber that looked very Spartan, lit by two candles standing on a table covered in green baize. The final words of the usher, who had just left him, were still buzzing in his ears. "Monsieur, you are now in the council chamber. You have only to turn the brass knob of this door, and you will be in the courtroom behind the chair of Monsieur le Président." Those words mingled in his thoughts with a dim memory of the narrow corridors and black stairs he had just traversed. The usher had left him on his own. The supreme moment had arrived. He tried to collect himself, but failed. It is especially at those moments when you most need to secure them to the poignant realities of life that all the loose threads of thought snap in your brain. He stood in the very spot where judges deliberate and sentence. In a calm daze, he gazed at that peaceful and fearful chamber where so many existences had been broken, where his name would soon ring out and his destiny be decided. He gazed at the wall, then he gazed at himself, marveling that it was this particular chamber, and that it was he himself. He hadn't eaten for more than 24 hours. He was shattered by the jolting of the carriole, but he didn't feel it. It seemed to him that he didn't feel a thing. He went up to a black frame hanging on the wall, which contained, behind glass, an old autograph letter of Jean-Nicolas Pache, mayor of Paris and minister, dated, no doubt by mistake, June 11th, year 2. In it, Pache was sending the commune the list of ministers and deputies placed under house arrest. An onlooker, able to see him and observe him in that instant, would no doubt have imagined that the letter seemed most curious to him, for he couldn't take his eyes off it, and read it over and over again. He read it without taking it in and without knowing what he was doing. He was thinking of Fantine and Cosette. While he was lost in thought, he turned round and his eyes fell on the brass knob of the door that separated him from the courtroom. He had almost forgotten about that door. His gaze, at first steady, stopped there, remained fixed on this brass knob. Then it turned wild and staring, and little by little was tinged with horror. Beads of sweat broke out on his scalp and streamed down his temples. At a certain point, he made a gesture with a sort of defiant authority, that indescribable movement perfectly embodying the meaning, "For God's sake, who's forcing me to do this?" Then he swung back again sharply, saw the door through which he had come, went to it, opened it, and went out. He was no longer in that room. He was outside, in a corridor, a long, narrow corridor, punctuated with steps and gates, which created all kinds of nooks and crannies, lit here and there by lamps similar to night lights for sick people. It was the corridor by which he had come. He took a deep breath, cocked his ear, not a sound behind him, not a sound in front of him. He began to run, as though someone were chasing him. When he had gone back round several of the sharp turns in the corridor, he listened again. There was still the same silence and the same gloaming all around him.
He was out of breath. He was tottering. He leaned against the wall. The stone was cold. His sweat was icy on his forehead. He straightened up with a shiver. Then and there, alone in the darkness, standing trembling with cold and perhaps something else, he thought long and hard. He had thought long and hard the whole night. He had thought long and hard the whole day. The only thing he could still hear inside him was the voice that said, "Woe is me." A quarter of an hour went by. Finally, he hung his head, sighed in anguish, dropped his arms to his side, and retraced his steps. He walked slowly as if utterly overcome. It felt as though someone had collared him as he fled and brought him back. He went back into the council chamber. The first thing he saw was the doorknob. This doorknob, round and of polished brass, gleamed in his eyes like some awful star. He gazed at it the way a lamb would gaze into the eyes of a tiger. He could not take his eyes off it. Now and then he took another step toward the door. Had he listened, he would have heard a confused buzz, the noise of the room next door, but he didn't listen. And he didn't hear. All of a sudden, without knowing how, he found himself right next to the door. He seized the knob convulsively. The door opened. He was in the courtroom. A place where convictions are about to shape up. He stepped inside, closed the door behind him, mechanically, and remained stock still, considering what he saw. It was a rather vast, dimly lit enclosure, now full of din, now full of silence, where the whole apparatus of a criminal trial unfolded in all its mean and mournful gravity before the multitude. At one end of the room, where he found himself, worried-looking judges in worn-out robes were biting their nails or closing their eyes. At the other end, the rabble in rags, lawyers in every possible pose, soldiers with hard, honest faces, tarnished old wainscoting, a dirty ceiling, tables covered in serge that was rather more yellow than green, doors blackened by hands, nails planted in the paneling, small tavern-style oil lamps providing more smoke than light. On the tables, candles and brass candlesticks. Gloom, ugliness, sadness. And from all this, a sense of the austere and the august emanated, for you could feel that great human thing known as the law and that great divine thing known as justice in that room. No one in the crowd paid the slightest attention to him. All eyes converged on a single point, a wooden bench backing onto a small door along the wall to the left of the presiding judge. On this bench, which was lit by several candles, there was a man between two gendarmes. This man was the man. He did not look for him, he saw him at once. His eyes gravitated toward him of their own accord, as though they had known in advance where he was. He felt as if he was looking at himself, older, not, of course, absolutely the same in the face, but alike in attitude and general look, with that hair sticking up, with those wild, anxious eyes, with that smock. Himself as he was the day he walked into Digne, full of hate and hiding in his soul that hideous store of frightening thoughts he had spent 19 years hoarding on the paving stones of jail. He said to himself with a shiver, "My God, is this what I'd come to again?" This creature appeared to be at least 60 years old. There was something indefinably coarse, stupid, and scared about him. At the sound of the door, people had stood aside to make room for him. The presiding judge had turned his head round, and realizing that the personage who had stepped in was Monsieur le Maire of Montreuil-sur-Mer, had nodded to him. The counsel for the prosecution, who had seen Monsieur Madeleine in Montreuil-sur-Mer, where the duties of his office had called him more than once, also greeted him. He scarcely registered them. He was in the grip of a sort of hallucination. He stared. Judges, a clerk, Gendarmes, a sea of heads, viciously curious. He had seen all that already once, 27 years ago. These deadly things had caught up with him once more. There they were, in front of him. They stirred once more. They existed. It was no longer an effort of memory, a mirage of his mind. Those were real gendarmes and real judges. A real horde and real flesh and blood men. It had happened. It was all over. He saw all the monstrous aspects of his past come to life again, reappearing all around him with all the frightening force of reality. This was all gaping before him. He was horrified by it. He closed his eyes and cried out from the bottom of his soul, "Never!" And by a tragic twist of fate that caused all his notions to totter and almost caused him to lose his mind, it was another self who was there. This man they were trying, they all called him Jean Valjean. He had before his eyes an unheard-of vision, a sort of reenactment of the most horrible moment of his life, played by his ghost. It was all there. It was the same apparatus, the same time of night, almost the same faces on the judges, soldiers, and members of the audience. Only, above the president's head there was a crucifix, something that was missing from the courtrooms at the time he was convicted. When he was tried, God had not been there. There was a chair behind him. He dropped into it, terrified at the idea that he could be seen. When he was seated, he took advantage of a pile of files sitting on the judge's desk to hide his face from the whole room. He could now see without being seen. Little by little, he recovered. He fully entered into a sense of reality. He attained that state of calmness that allows you to listen. Monsieur Bamatabois was one of the jurors. He looked for Javert but couldn't see him. The witness bench was hidden from him by the clerk's table. Then again, as we've said, the room was barely lit. When he entered, the defense counsel was winding up his speech for the defense. Everyone's attention was roused to its highest pitch. The matter had been going on for 3 hours. For 3 hours, this crowd had watched as a man, an unknown man, some kind of miserable specimen, either profoundly stupid or profoundly clever, gradually buckled under the weight of a terrible probability. This man, as we already know, was a tramp who had been found in a field carrying a branch laden with ripe apples, torn off an apple tree in a neighboring enclosure known as Pierron Close. Who was this man? An investigation had been conducted. Witnesses had just been heard. They had been unanimous. Sure knowledge had shone forth out of the whole sorry deliberations. The prosecution was saying, "We are not only holding a fruit thief, a poacher, we are holding here in our hands a crook, a backslider at odds with the world who has broken parole. An ex-convict, a villain of the most dangerous kind, a criminal called Jean Valjean, wanted by the law for a long time, and who 8 years ago, when he came out of jail in Toulon, committed highway robbery under force of arms against the person of a young boy from Savoy called Petit Gervais, a crime under Article 383 of the Criminal Code, for which we reserve the right to pursue him further, when his identity is legally established. He has just committed a fresh theft. This is a case of recidivism. Convict him for the new crime, he will be tried for the old crime later." Faced with such an accusation, faced with the unanimity of the witnesses, the accused seemed above all amazed. He made gestures and signs that meant no, or else he examined the ceiling. He scarcely spoke, gave awkward answers, but from head to toe his entire person screamed that he was not guilty as charged. He was like the village idiot in the presence of all these fine minds ranged in battle around him, or like a foreigner in the midst of this society that had him by the throat. It had meant the most menacing future for him. The probability of his conviction was growing every minute, and the whole crowd was looking, more anxiously than he was, at the disastrous sentence that was hanging over him more and more ominously. One possibility opened up the prospect beyond jail of the death penalty. If his identity was established, and if the Petit Gervais matter were to end up resulting in a conviction. What was this man? What was the nature of his apathy? Was it imbecility or a ruse? Did he understand only too well, or did he not understand at all? Questions that divided the crowd and seemed to split the jury. There was something frightening and something intriguing in this trial. The drama was not only sinister, it was obscure. The defense counsel had given a pretty good summing up in that provincial lingo that had long constituted the eloquence of the bar and that lawyers used to use in days gone by. Every bit as much in Romorantin as in Paris, or Montbrison, which today, having become classic and therefore old hat, is scarcely spoken any more other than by the official orators of the bar, for whom it is most useful in its grave sonority and its majestic tone. A language in which a husband or a wife is called a spouse, Paris, the center of the arts and of civilization, the king, the monarch, my lord bishop, the holy pontiff, the counsel for the prosecution, the eloquent interpreter for the prosecution, the speech for the defense, the strains we have just heard, the century of Louis XIV, the Grand Siècle, a theater, a temple of Melpomene, the reigning royal family, the august blood of our kings, a concert, a solemn celebration of music, the general in command, the illustrious warrior who, etc. Theology students, those gentle Levites, mistakes imputed to newspapers, the imposture that distills its venom in the columns of these organs, etc., etc. The lawyer had accordingly begun by expatiating on the theft of the apples, something difficult enough to do in the grandiloquent manner, but Benigne Bossuet himself was once forced to refer to a hen in the middle of a funeral oration, and he carried it off with alacrity. The defense attorney had established that the theft of the apples had not been materially proved. His client, whom, in his role as defense counsel, he insisted on calling Champmathieu, had not been seen by anyone scaling the wall or breaking off the branch. He had been arrested in possession of said branch, which the lawyer happily dubbed a bough, but he claimed to have found it on the ground and to have picked it up. Where was the proof to the contrary? Undoubtedly, the branch had been broken off and concealed after he had scaled the wall and then thrown away by the alarmed poacher. Undoubtedly there had been a thief, but what proved that this thief was Champmathieu? A single thing, his status as an ex-convict. The attorney did not deny that this status appeared, unfortunately, to be clearly proved. The accused had resided in Faverolles. The accused had been a pruner there. The name Champmathieu could well have started out as Jean Mathieu. All that was true. Finally, four witnesses recognized Champmathieu positively and without hesitation as being the galley slave Jean Valjean. To these points and to this testimony, the attorney could only oppose his client's denial, a self-interested denial. But supposing he were the convict Jean Valjean, did that prove that he was the stealer of the apples? That was an assumption at most, not proof. The defendant, it was true, and the defense counsel had to agree, in good faith, had adopted a bad defense strategy. He persisted in denying everything, both the theft and his status as an ex-convict. Admission on this last point would certainly have been better and would have earned him the judge's indulgence. The defense counsel had advised him to take this course, but the accused had obstinately persisted in refusing to do so, no doubt thinking he'd save the whole situation by not admitting anything. It was a mistake, but was it not necessary to consider the limited nature of the man's intelligence? The man was obviously a cretin. A horrible long stretch in jail and a miserable long stretch out of jail had brutalized him, etc., etc. He defended himself badly, but was that a reason to convict him? As for the Petit Gervais matter, it was not the job of the defense counsel to discuss it. It was not under consideration. The attorney summed up by beseeching